from Denver, Colorado, and I come today as a colleague in university and as a citizen of the United States, because there's some interesting things I think that we're going to explore together. The reality is health is really the outcome of healthcare, and if the U.S. were only more like Finland, we would be a lot better off. How many of you find that a surprising statement? Does that sound like the Finnish people are much more healthy than the United States? Yeah, you already knew that? So we're going to talk about what that means, and we're going to talk about the U.S. health care system beyond Obamacare. How many of you have heard the term Obamacare? Oh, wow, lots of people have heard that term. We'll talk about what that really means. It has a very political connotation. But we'll also talk about the world reality is that it's not just the U.S. that's facing the same challenges in terms of creating health as individuals and then accessing care as we need it. And we'll talk about the implications for you all at the University of Jyväskylä. I think there's some great opportunities. Tony and I are working on some digitization and some opportunities around that, around system efficiency, pharma effectiveness. In the U.S., we spend about 20% of our $3 trillion annual spend on pharmaceuticals, about half of which are really never taken or taken correctly, and so we don't get the benefit from that. So we'll talk about the opportunities for digitization around that. And then really, how do we use digitization to move us from healthcare to health, and how we got there. And we'll talk about kind of two paths forward and really kind of explore some opportunities and then hopefully have some dialogue. So if the U.S. were only more like Finland, I, as a woman, would live 3 years longer at birth. If you were to look at my life expectancy at birth, I would live 3 years longer. The reality is that in 1970, we were about the same, the U.S. and Finland. But since then, Finland has expedited the life expectancy by 10 years. And the U.S., it's only been about 7 years. And so you're going to hear about our investment structure. That's a very concerning activity because we're actually, for the first time, we're less than about 35 countries that that report into what's called the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's a very sad statement, especially when you see the kind of money that we're expending. The things that we have areas of improvement, you'll see the yellow underlined, are where we're in the bottom third. The U.S. is in the bottom one-third of performers. And in that OECD, there's about 35 countries, some of which are developing countries, like China. We're not talking just about European countries and developed nations in South America. Infant mortality, we do a pretty terrible job at. We're ranked 28th. Our actual numbers, we actually have 5 deaths per 1,000 live births, whereas in Finland you have 1.7. And low birth weight infants is a problem. Cancer incidence, almost half again as much as in Finland. Transport accidents, we drive really fast and we're kind of reckless in the United States. And you can see our transport accidents are twice as high. But the reality is it's the expense that we're incurring that's really driving the changes in the U.S. Life expectancy at birth, spending per capita in Finland is less than $4,000. It's about $3,600 per capita. In the U.S., it's over $8,500. There's only 5.5 million people in Finland. There's 330 million in the U.S. So that's a very big number. It's a $3 trillion annual spend. And the biggest problem is that the quality of the care does not even meet the needs of the people. So when we think about things like asthma and diabetes, kind of ongoing chronic condition management, Finland does a great job at that. The U.S. is, in the bottom third. Where we do really well is, I don't know how many of you have seen U.S. television shows, but we've seen a lot of them on TV. We've been in country for about a week now. We're really good in the U.S. at things like heart attack and stroke, emergency room. We have lots of television shows about emergency room, and you can see it in our care as well. Breast cancer survival rates are higher. We had a woman named Susan G. Komen. She started a big foundation, walk, and there's a lot of energy and activities around breast cancer, and it does pay when you put energy towards that. But the thing is, when we look at healthcare coverage, you know, Finland's number one. The U.S. really isn't number three. There were only three segments, and again, we were in the bottom third. But it's really this spend and unmet need that continues to be a problem in the U.S. healthcare system. So again, as we talked about, the U.S. is number one, and so here we have where number one is really maybe not a good thing. We're number one in per capita expenditures. Again, the actual is $8,700, $16.4% of our GDP. Finland is $3,400, 8.6% of GDP. And the average for all of the OECD is about what Finland is. It's $3,400. And that we're just spending a tremendous amount of dollars to not get a return on our investment. So that's why you see the activities and hear about things like Obamacare, and we'll talk about the policy implications of that. It's interesting to note when you look at generalists versus specialists, the U.S., 88% of our spend is with specialists. We have 88% of our doctors are specialists. So whereas in Finland, you have about 45% are specialists and 36% are generalists, 19% are other, but really tend to be more generalists. The thing that really stands out is if you look at things like MRIs and CTs, pharmaceutical expenditures, like I talked about, is about 20% of that annual $3 trillion. Our spend on pharmaceuticals is more than twice what yours is in Finland. And the number of scans. I was relaying to the dean that I had to have some hip surgery. I had to go to three specialists. I had five MRIs. I had a CT. 9 months later, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do about the condition that I had, and I had to have multiple because this doctor did not like the MRI that doctor did or the way that MRI clinic did it, and so they ordered another one. I should glow in the dark. I've had so many medical imaging technologies. So again, the challenge is not only do we have a high spend, but these numbers just came out, and our projected growth rate is about 5.8% per year between now and 2025, which means that that's going to be about 1.3% faster than gross domestic product. And so we're going to go from 17.5% to about 20%. It was interesting flying in on Thin Air. They had a very nice brochure on what the economy of it is of Finland. They don't break out healthcare. In the U.S., we break out healthcare because it's 20% of our economy, and it's really on sick care. So these are some very shocking and some very trying numbers for us as a citizen of the American healthcare system. My insurance rates go up and up and up every year. My health doesn't change, but I'm paying for all of the sick care that's going on in our country. So the funding dilemma that we have is that in Finland and in most OECD countries, 100% of it is covered, you know, by a government service. In the U.S., that's only 34.5%. 54% is private insurance. So you may have a supplemental plan, but we as citizens, only certain people can get government insurance if you're low income or if you're over 65 years of age. So I cannot get government health care. I have to have private health care. And we have an uninsured rate of 10%. That is really the driver behind the policy of Obamacare. It was health insurance reform. It really wasn't health care delivery reform. It was about getting people into some kind of expanded government program or requiring people to have some kind of private insurance. If we do not have private insurance, we do not qualify for a government plan, we have to pay a tax. And because many young people, like you all, said, hey, I don't need health insurance, I'm healthy. But now we say everybody has to be in the pool. Just like if you drive a car, you have to have car insurance, you have to have health insurance. So again, the numbers that drove Obamacare were in 2010 when the Affordable Care Act was implemented, was we had 18.2%, almost 20%, almost one in five people were uninsured. And many times it wasn't that they didn't want to be insured, but our insurance is heavily predicated on our employment, and some employers opt not to provide health care insurance. And so if they opted not to, you had to go into the private market as an individual, and that you paid excessive, one, two, three, four times more than what I would pay if I were on my employer's health plan. And so that's why we had Obamacare. We created health insurance exchanges where people could come together as groups and get a better rate. So today, again, that number has dropped to 10.7%, again, due to public policy. We are the only country where private insurance is allowed to profit from basic insurance. And that really drives a lot of the cost structure. Our insurance companies make quite a bit of money. They reinvest it into various things, but they are allowed to profit from our private insurance. Other companies allow profit only on supplemental policies. We are the only country that allows profiteering on private health plans. The other area that we're very different, I didn't have information on Finland, but in the US, we spend 16%, and you hear that number is going to 20% of GDP on health insurance. We spend about 9% on social services. In most other countries, you spend about 20%, 10 to 20% on social services, and you're only 9, 10, 11% on healthcare. And it's a very different model. We have people who are coming to our emergency rooms because they need a sandwich. There's no social services available for them. And so that's a problem as a country. So again, our healthcare system has become very political, but the real problem is our health is much worse off than it was even 30 years ago. In 1980, I'll show you some statistics. And basically, when you start looking at the directional change, out-of-pocket spend has gone up. So if you were an economist, you'd say to get people to take better care of their health, you make them pay more for it. It's not proven in healthcare, in the creation of health. Because what's ended up happening is we've had a higher incident rate of adolescent obesity. You can see this line. We've had childhood obesity, again, has gone up 2 to 3 times since 1980. And extreme obesity has risen to over 4%. So we've got some very extreme things that are happening with our children. In addition to us as adults, we have children who are now what we would previously call adult onset diabetes. They're now on diabetes medication at 14 years of age. They live to 65. That's over 50 years of paying for healthcare for something that is a preventable condition. So the impact of poor health is not just that it takes away our GDP to do innovative things like in energy or in transportation. It's that it really lowers our ability to be productive in the workforce. We're productive taking care of sick people as opposed to doing innovative things that are outside of the realm. The other reality is that 86% of our dollars are now going to chronic diseases, and many of those are preventable. And that's a really difficult statement and I'll talk about this later, but when we started health insurance, it was very akin to what you would have with car insurance. It was to pay for hospitalization. It was only if you got very sick, you had an emergency appendectomy, and you had to go into the hospital, insurance would pay for hospitalization. Much of what we pay for in chronic disease is not hospitalization. Hospitalization is the expensive part of it, but it's this ongoing care. Diabetes care, on average, will cost you out of pocket between $8,000 and $9,000 per year. And so what that means is we've kind of medicalized and what I call monetized. We know how to keep you alive longer, but you don't have the best quality of life. Your health should enable you to go do things. I was fortunate enough to come in. My husband and I came in, and we went to Turku, and we biked the short route of the archipelago. That was a goal. We wanted to bike in Europe. And so we crossed off our bucket list because we could do that. many people, many of our friends would be very, it would be very difficult for them to take on an activity like that. So the reality is that the health determinants on early mortality are much driven around our behaviors and our management of genetic predispositions. I know I have type 2 diabetes in my family. My father had it, my grandfather had it. They did not get it until they were 70 years old because we managed it. I know I need to go and have my blood sugar checked. I need to manage my weight. I need to manage my life so that I, you know, if I get it, it's as late as possible, but hopefully I never get it because it's a preventable disease. And we'll talk about what's going on with diabetes around the world. So again, many of the things that we're spending dollars on, 55 to 65% of it is preventable. And it's based on our behaviors and our activities. So the real dilemma that we have in the U.S. is certainly, you know, kind of the 80-20 rule, if you look at it. 25% of the population consumes 86% of the dollars. But it's this last 50%, when we look at numbers like this, where our incident rates are quadrupling, you have to wonder, what is the health of that last 50%? We're spending 2.8% of $3 trillion on those people, and many of them have preventable diseases. We talk about diabetes. What about pre-diabetics? You can test and measure and know when people are out of range. We talk about where are they getting their health information? What is their health literacy? These are things that digitization can help us with because we can deliver information to people as they're starting to be ready to consume it. And then how are we managing their health and wellness pre and post disease? We think post disease, we think once you get something, I have to change my life, but the reality is you can change it beforehand. So the top drivers of the US healthcare system and where there are greatest opportunities is certainly waste in the system. And we talked about it earlier with the Dean and Tony, and you know, many of the things that are going on around electronic health records so that we can look at things like overtreatment and failures of care coordination. It's very difficult for me as a non-clinician if I get one disease, especially if I have to go to multiple specialists. You can see we don't use the primary care system very well. Many people, once they get sick, they take their roll-aboard luggage and it has all their electronic health record in, because the chances of their doctor, you know, their endocrinologist and their orthopedist and, you know, their primary care doctor having their information is slim to none. So one of the things that we have opportunities in is certainly reducing waste, and we'll talk about what the U.S. is doing around electronic health records, health information exchanges to address that from a digitization perspective. We've done some policy work around the Affordable Care Act, again, to get people into the system to provide access to health insurance. But another big area that we have is the biotech and pharmacy world. You know, we're spending $600 billion a year on pharmaceuticals. There's probably an opportunity of $200 to $300 billion on just making sure people are compliant, using technology to remind people to take medications, using the quantified self, using things like Fitbits and monitoring capabilities to know when you should be taking medicine as opposed to when you may not need to take it. We've spent a lot of money on robotics and technology innovations, but the reality is frequently our innovations are very expensive and they have limited improvement in the outcomes. And so as part of our Affordable Care Act, we said that we were going to go after value-based purchasing. So every time somebody purchases a healthcare item, whether it's a hospitalization stay or a pharmaceutical, we're now saying to that industry, you have to prove that you improved the outcome because we've spent money with you and pharmaceuticals cannot do it. They are now partnering like crazy with digitization, quantified self folks, because they cannot prove that the $600 billion per year, we're not talking about $600 billion once, we're talking about it per year, that that's actually adding value to the health of our people. The other area that we need to be looking at more at is treating this preventable disease. This $500 million to $1 trillion a year is really being spent on stuff that could have been prevented way upstream. And you know, that doesn't include the productivity loss. It's really hard for people to get up and go to work when they're sick. They have higher sick days, they retire earlier. It's really starting to jeopardize people's ability to have money to retire in the United States. And that's an area that my research is working on. I'm working with an economist, a health economist at the University of Colorado, and an actuary in South Africa, and we've got a model built, because it's been shown that over the last 15 years, people's individual income is being severely eroded, their disposable income, by their payments towards health insurance and these out-of-pocket costs, that they really don't have the money to retire. And more importantly, now if you're retiring sick, it's really going to put you in a bind. So these are our friends, the puffins. Has anybody ever seen a puffin? Atlantic puffins are a little rare around here, but we happen to see them in Maine. And the reality is, the puffins are kind of my hero because, you know, they kind of get it. They like to live independently, but they like to come together and solve problems. And they're really asking us to think differently. Did you know that this preventable disease problem is not just in the U.S.? It's a global issue. And this non-communicable disease, which the World Health Organization defines as cardiovascular disease, cancer, certain cancers, diabetes, chronic lung disease, generally from smoking, are the leading cause of death globally, killing more people each year than all other causes combined. So 36 million deaths around the world, two-thirds of all deaths, are really from preventable types of activities. They're clinically well understood, and we have cost-effective and feasible interventions, but they're not working, is the reality. And really, it's the cause is our rapid urbanization and our 21st century lifestyle. Tobacco use, unhealthy diet, insufficient physical activity, and harmful use of alcohol. So when we start looking at something specific like diabetes, it's a global issue, and it's getting worse. The total incident rate in 1995 for 130 countries was 35 million. It grew by 12% in just 5 years. Think about what other economic indicator increased that fast in 5 years, 12%. And then if you look at the estimates for 170 countries, in 2015 it was 415 million people. In another 25 years, we're estimating a 55% increase. That's about $673 billion, 12% of the global health expenditures, and 9% in Europe. Today, it's 1 in 11 people have diabetes. By 2040, it's estimated that 1 in 10 will. In Europe, those numbers were at 9%, ages 20 to 79. And over 50, it's estimated that 31% of people in 2015 have diabetes. By 2040, that number is going up to almost 36%. The reality is those lifestyle changes, with lifestyle changes like achieving a healthy body weight, moderate physical activities, you can prevent the development of type 2 diabetes. So what? It might be me? What do you mean it might be me? Well, even in Finland, you know, we started out saying that Finland was a great place, and if I were only born in Finland, I'd live 3 years longer. But mortality from cardiovascular disease is increasing. Again, Finland outranks the U.S. in that bottom third category for ischemic heart disease and cerebral cardiovascular disease. And look at the life expectancy at 65 years. So whereas it was 3 years at birth, we kind of caught up by the time we got to 65. If we all lived to 65, we're really only going to live about another 20 years, 19 years. And if you start looking at life years at age 65 in European countries, it's about 9 years for women and 8 years for men. And then this is really the disconcerting number. The number of people reporting good or very good health In Finland, it's only 40%, and that's a subjective thing. But if we look at the strongly limited in activities over 65 years, the U.S. doesn't report that, but in Finland, it was about 16% of people said that they were strongly limited at 65 years and above. In Norway and Sweden, it was only about 10% of people said that. So again, I mean, as we age, we want to be retired, we want to be barking the archipelago, we want to be living out our bucket list, and we don't want to be strongly limited in our daily activities if we don't have to be. And there's probably some activities that we could change that would help us not be so limited. Smoking in the U.S. Has dropped. You can see in 2013, it was 14.5%. In 2000, it was 19% in the U.S. Finland's doing a good job as well. It was 23% in the year 2000. It's dropped 7% to the year 2013. It's lower than the OECD group. Alcohol consumption is headed the right direction. It's headed the wrong direction. It used to be 8.4 liters per capita, and now it's 9 liters in the U.S. It was 9 liters per capita in 2000. It's 9.3. Doesn't seem like a lot, but when you start looking at the top 20% of people in the U.S., 73% of the people consume that 20%, so that's almost your 80-20 rule. And in the U.S., the big thing we have going on is microbrews. There's one on every country, on every corner, it seems like. Where we live in Littleton, Colorado, a suburb of Denver, within a 4 or 5 mile radius, about 6 kilometers, there's like 4 or 5 microbrews. They just put them up in a little warehouse and get them going, and it's like the neighborhood bar. And it's great, but it's like the consumption is going up instead of down. The big thing that you hear about in the U.S. is obesity, and we are dead last in obesity of the OECD countries. And Finland is at number 26, so you're better than the U.S. But still, I mean, there's opportunities for improvement. The U.S. Certainly, in terms of obesity in children, as you saw from the other numbers, has quadrupled in the last 30 years. And it's really an area that we want to be mindful of, because if you set your health up when you're young, it really sets you up for the activities that are going to be available to you as you get older. These are prescription drug consumption. U.S. does not report, but when you look at the Finland actuals, you're actually number one for consumption of diabetic drugs of the 30-some countries reporting. And cholesterol medications, you're number 4. And so again, I mean, I think we all have opportunities to create dialogue around a social norm about health and what is our citizens' right, but our citizens' responsibility as we think about our health. Because it really does make a difference in the quality of the life that you have while you're here. Again, things like eating fruits and vegetables. Finland, of the countries that reported, Finland was the lowest, and they were the second lowest in reporting among eating vegetables. Although I have to say, every place I've been, there's vegetables on 3 meals a day. So we've had lots of vegetables since we've been here. So again, health insurance, when it started out, by definition, it was an insurance pool. It was a risk pool, and it was designed for catastrophic, which means rare, activities. And in the case of the U.S. healthcare system, it was originally designed to cover acute conditions. So an acute is an immediate onset condition of a hospitalization. But now it's being used to pay for chronic disease. And that's problematic, because once you're in a chronic disease condition, you end up with multiple chronic disease numbers. I think the last numbers I saw were that 50% of the U.S. population has some chronic disease, some form of chronic disease, but the number, about 40% of that, the 50%, has two or three or four conditions. So again, as this burden from chronic disease and aging increases, the prevalence of disease, the cost is going to continue to increase. And at what point will addressing the root cause of preventable disease become important? It's eroding personal net worth, and right now there's work being done by several research organizations, including the work that I'm doing, on what that means for people's ability to support themselves in retirement. So Mr. Puffin says, it is me. So now what am I going to do about it? Well, I think there's some opportunities to reframe the problem. In the healthcare system today, I spent about 12 years in the fourth largest healthcare system in the U.S. We were in 19 states. We had over 100 hospitals. We had literally thousands of physician offices. We had 42 long-term care centers. We had a home health, one of the largest home health centers in the country. But the clinical treatment that gets paid for is really driven, the clinical care that gets delivered is really driven largely by what insurance will pay for. It really incents people to activate into the system and engage with the system. And it really assumes people are consistent, rational, self-aware. And again, as we've talked about, our 21st century lifestyle has really kind of exploited what I would call our deeply human flaws. We're overly optimistic. We love instant gratification. I think that's why all these Pokemon guys are out there looking for their Pokemon. The need for speed. And we really discount the future. We say today, well, I'm not as healthy as I could be, but maybe tomorrow I will get there. The great news is that at the same time, researchers are learning more about what is driving human behavior, unconsciously, consciously, socially, and in the moment. There's more work being done around neurosciences, behavioral economics, physiology, sociology, in the field of medicine. I mean, it's not just the technologies and robotics and surgeries, but really how do we deliver better care politically? How do we do a better job with policies that are effective? And how do people learn? And how do we provide education that's meaningful and not memorization and in the moment as people are experiencing their world? So what we're learning about human behavior is that our emotions, our subconscious, does play a larger role in our decision-making than we thought in the past. Rationality is bounded by emotions. What we're finding is that without an emotional reaction, we don't know how to value our reasoning. So people who've had brain damage and don't have that emotional stimulation, they can't reason. They cannot make decisions. And those steps in decision-making are about perception. And we know that perceptions can be faulty. We can make a perception, and then it gets challenged later, and we realize that we did not interpret that correctly. And then we reason, and we calculate our options, and we use power of will to actually execute a decision. So we also know that we are social and predictably irrational. This is where the opportunity for digitization and technology comes in. If we are predictably something, we can digitize it and intercede. So again, those influences are social, who we interact with, our social network, not just on Facebook, but those 3 to 7 people who actually influence our behaviors create that relativity, those social norms. And the result is we underestimate or completely ignore, we filter, we groupthink, we perceive in biased ways, and most of all, we discount the future. And I think our health is a great example of human behavior gone awry in a way, because we've made this assumption that we're logical and rational, and we are in what Dan Ariely, a leading behavioral economist, would say, in our cold state. If we had an agreement with our physician and we say we're going to do this, and then I get over here, I'm with my friends, it's like, yeah, I kind of remember that. Well, what if we had some digitization, some Pokemon that could help us remind us that we made that commitment? Self-control is another area that's an essential ingredient of a fulfilling life. We found that it's twice as important as IQ in predicting high school performance. Yet we as humans are not good at self-control due to overconfidence, peer pressure, laziness, self-delusion, and we lack strength and self-awareness to directly control our unconscious processes if we even perceive them at all. And so the good news is we're starting to think about these and study things and learn about how people behave. In you know those things that like self-control, self-discipline, people want to be self-reliant. They have self-determination. But where I think the opportunities around digitization are in self-awareness and self-control, because you can develop habits and strategies that trigger that unconscious process that enables people to perceive the world in really productive and far-seeing ways. And if you want a good read, read David Brooks' book, The Social Animal. He's a very interesting writer, but he also has studied policy in the U.S. for the last 30-plus years. And he wrote the book because he was so frustrated with all of this work and activity that went into designing policies and, you know, around education systems and healthcare, and that it wasn't working. So, again, human errors are predictable, systemic, and they're expressible as math formulas. Choice architectures really frame human decision-making. If we don't make this choice, we make this choice. We make it based on different choices. Again, can we incorporate those various learnings into our digitization processes, directly, indirectly, using technologies to create social norms, using things like priming or anchoring or framing or expectation setting, inertia. People are very averse to loss, and so how can we use technology to help frame and get people in their cold state, in their rational state, to understand so that in their hot state, in their emotional state, they won't make a different decision. So we also know that the social determinants of health are another framework for analyzing opportunities. This is things like economic stability, education level, neighborhood and your built environment. Do you live in a safe neighborhood? What's your access to healthcare? Your social and community context? What's your culture that you're associated with? The research that I have presented here today is really focused on new research to help understand human behavior. It doesn't discount each one of those. There's a lot of work that's going on around social determinants, but what this frames is the basic human nature of human behaviors and health. So what are the implications for the University of Jyväskylä? So again, the implications for digital innovations are around system inefficiencies. Using it to reduce waste, improve outcomes. Again, over-treatment and failures of care coordination, failures to execute care processes, administrative complexity. All of those things are what technology is very good at getting rid of. It's good at creating workflow paths. It's good at creating and integrating data so that you don't have to repeat your address and your family history every time you go see a doctor. And then care processes. As we talked about, if you discharge from the doctor and they send you home with orders, is there a way that we could digitize that to remind you to do your exercises? I had hip surgery, so I needed to do a lot of physical therapy. But I didn't just do it when I was with the physical therapist. I had to do a lot of exercises when I was away from the physical therapist. Addressing the biopharma ineffectiveness. We pay a lot of money for pharmaceuticals, and very little benefit is seen from that. And it's really every pharma company, this is new research that just came out this summer, every pharma company in the U.S. kind of has a fire lit to them that they had better figure out how they're going to prove value or they're not going to get paid in the future, or there's going to be some severe penalties to them. And so they need a digitalization strategy. And there's also this ability to influence our behaviors and prevent disease. Again, irrationality is common, but once we understand it and we get people to kind of address what their goals are, how do you use the technology to create guardrails? We have speed limits. We are used to having, data around us, and we're used to technology moving us. It's amazing what the Pokemon Go thing has done. It really has got people out and moving. Before, if you wanted to play games, you had to be on your Game Boy. But now people are going out, and they're searching, and they're walking, and they're doing things. They're walking into lakes and off of cliffs, too. But they're moving. And how do we use this augmented reality to help people help themselves is a question I think we all need to ask ourselves. So as we think about research possibilities from a School of Humanities perspective, how do we look at cooperation? How do we look at consumerism? How do we look at digital communications from an economics and a business perspective? You know, what are the economics of unhealth? That's what I'm spending a fair amount of time on finance and personal wealth. Digital marketing of health, sports and health science, fitness, nutrition, literacy, education. How do we use the latest technologies in education to teach people what it means to be healthy? Mathematics and statistics, certainly choice architecture can be mathematically derived. Social sciences, the household production of health, integrating social sciences on a micro level. There's been some really good research done in this area around the production of health at the household level. And then technology, certainly computational sciences, the analysis and the modeling, taking that data from individual activities, bringing it back, understanding processes, understanding how we interact with our social networks, and certainly integrating data across systems. And we'll see an example of that in a moment. So, as healthcare professionals, I think healthcare professionals in the future are going to be even more challenged to improve system effectiveness because today, as we said in the U.S., 88% of our physicians are specialists. They're now over here. It's no longer going to be okay to be a cardiologist and not care what the implications of cardiovascular drugs are on someone's kidneys, somebody has to go to the nephrologist, or what it's doing to their weight or their ability to be active. If their primary care is telling them, hey, you need to do this, and my cardiologist is telling me this, how do we interact and how do we provide a single message to people? Certainly from a biopharma, we certainly can take a pill to cure an ill, but the digital health solutions that are emerging are really going to enable better partnerships with people, not just when they become patients. We can't wait until people are sick to care enough to help them manage their health. Mental health work is just beginning in the U.S., and we'll talk about a more detailed example of that. It's a big area. And then health behaviors. Again, today, health behaviors are largely outside of medical practice. When I came back from being a visiting scholar at Indiana University, I studied a Nobel Prize-winning governance model called Governance of the Commons. I looked at the emergence of medical commons, so clinicians working together in concert to create population health. I looked at what communities were doing to provide nice bike paths and access to healthy foods. And I met with one of our what we call chief accountable care officers, and he looked at me and he said, but we tell them what to do. We tell those people what to do. And I was like, well, how's that working out for you? You could tell people what to do, and then they leave, and they go, hey, you told me what to do, but you don't understand me. You don't understand my life. You don't understand the things that are important to me. And so there's this big disconnect between health creation and healthy behaviors and medical practice in the U.S. It's a very big disconnect, and it's going to have to change. So today, Tony's working on a digitization research project that looks at home-to-home treatment trains, identifying the most potential targets for new areas of innovations. And it's very exciting to be part of that dialogue because I think there's a huge opportunity to do things in Finland and then scale them around the world because there's certainly opportunity. As we think about it, as I thought about when I was the vice president of enterprise analytics, We looked many times internally at standard reports and reporting and queries and drill downs and alerts, but in reality, we were kind of innovating within the box that we knew. What we really need to be doing is statistical analysis and forecasting and predictive modeling so that we can optimize the entire system, not just clinical care, but people and their lives. And so this is a huge area that has opportunity for big data and research and the focus of where we can look. And what I would say is it's not just how people are consuming healthcare, it's the consumerism data, it's the digital footprint that's out there about each one of us that will actually be the key to unlocking how to communicate and how to use digital technologies. So if we look at system inefficiencies, in the U.S., we're using payment policy reform, again, Obamacare, to say, hey, you have to deliver, you have to pay for value. Fraud and abuse is another area that's a big problem in the U.S. Just since 2007, we've collected over $7 billion in fraud and abuse. And so that's another area we're using digitization and technology. It's important to note that any time that you adopt anything, even something as basic as penicillin, Madame Curie, you know, found that in whatever year, but it took another probably, I think it was about 50 years to get penicillin adopted. From a U.S. Perspective, it takes about 17 years on average for new knowledge generated by randomized controlled trials to be adopted. So this is a long runway that we're talking about. We start today. We keep working. I think we've got you all as young people who grew up digital natives much more so than when I grew up. And then the clinical practice models. Today it assumes very rational, logical, that we're going to make these, you know, very clear decision. But when we look at the evidence, what we look to is that about 60% of the time we look at our friends and family and go, what do you think I should do? And we say, yeah, the doctor said that, but what do you think I should do? And it's true. I mean, we look online. 80% of the time we go online for health information. People have joked that it's Dr. Google. I mean, we just go Google it. I mean, we started with WebMD, but now we just, hey, you know, I got this pain. Let's go Google it and see what Google says. We don't even, you know, go to the doctor, especially in the U.S. We are now migrating to what we call high deductible plans. So we have to pay $5,000 per person before the doctor gets paid by the insurance. So what's the likelihood if I bump my elbow and I got a bruise and I'm wondering if it's okay, what's the likelihood I'm going to go to the doctor? I'm not going to the doctor. I'm going to look on Dr. Google, see what they tell me to do. And then the social and neural networks have an opportunity to focus in our behaviors and our health. So again, as we think about technologies for system efficiency, in the U.S., we've implemented electronic health records. We actually paid physicians and hospitals to do that. At this point, the adoption rate, about 4.3% of providers are at what we call HIMSS Level 7, which is a health informatics organization. And that means that you no longer need a paper chart. 4% of doctors are using medical records enough that you don't need a piece of paper. It's kind of a low number, just saying. So again, our challenges are there's no single person identifier where you have a social security number. We do not use a social security number in healthcare. The health insurance plan assigns us an ID. Every year I renew my health insurance. I may change plans and go to this high deductible plan. So in 2015, maybe my number was 123. Now 2016, my number is ABC. So we dump it in Tony's database, and he says, is ABC equal to 123? I don't know. And so we have to create these matching algorithms, and it's pretty complicated to actually get the data back out. So these integration technologies are really needed to reduce the cost and improve the coordination of care. And if you look at the adoption rates, this is on the hospital side. And if you look at, we have about 5,600 community hospitals, that's not counting academics and some of the other government healthcare like Veterans Health. And there's a group called Cerner Corporation that has about 1,000 of that 56, so not quite 20%. Meditech is another system. Epic, which some of you may have heard that word around here. There's some people in Finland talking about, should we go to Epic? Again, this is just on the hospital side. The real challenge that we have, though, is there's 122 other commercial vendors that have 933 installations. So when you look at the number in these top three, it's about 50% or so is in this top three. But we still have 50% of the care is being driven here. And that's a lot of different systems and a lot of, I'll say, mess. So if you look at on the physician practice side, on the physician office or the clinic side, Epic, by far and away, has about 83,000 installs. But if you look at all other commercial vendors, there's 574 of them out there. They have 87,000. So Epic's not quite half. You can see the numbers. These are the certified technologies. Hopefully, we'll have more and more certified technologies. But we have a lot of activity out there. So if you, like in my case, I had these 100 hospitals, these thousands of physician offices. We spent 1 year implementing digitization and analytics into the database. We got through 1 year. We said, good, we're done. Oh, we forgot like 25 physician offices. I'm like, how do you just like forget them? Aren't they on payroll? Don't you know where they are? So it's very complicated to get a comprehensive list. And if you look at the comparatives, you can see, again, on the ambulatory side, Epic has about 83,000. They have 22% of the market. But again, this all other commercial, 586 different vendors, has 36% of the market. On the hospital side, on the acute side, Cerner is about 14%, Epic's about 11%. And hospitals, there's 137 other vendors out there that have 43% of the market. And the other thing I would say is just because you have Epic doesn't mean you have Epic, because every build is customized. I can just tell you, we tried to reuse systems, and it was very, very challenging. Every time you tried to reuse it, then you had to get agreement across systems. And we have no patient common patient identifier. So again, if I come in this year as this, I go into this system, I get a patient ID for coming into that system. This is my visit ID. That has nothing to do with me. It's not persistent. It's just for a visit. I might have a medical record number that follows me in the hospital. But in the physician practice world, in this world, there's no such thing as a medical record number. Even to say, I came into the, I broke my arm, I came in, they did x-rays, they casted it, I come back next week, it's another visit. They have no way of knowing that that's me the same time. There's no common identifier. So from a digitization perspective, it's very, very, very challenging. The other thing I would note is this does not include 9.6 million active military families and their beneficiaries. Those folks actually selected Cerner. 8.7 are veterans. They actually have a custom system that they built for themselves in the Veterans Administration because they don't create a claim. They don't bill because it's all money coming out of the government services. So it's very complicated. And then we also have things like Indian Health Services. So there's lots of buckets of people in the U.S. that get their care in very different ways. So So again, if we look at the number of registered hospital systems, again, there's 5,600 of them. If we look at the number in a system, which means that they either a multi-hospital or a diversified single hospital system, that just means it may be standalone. It may not be integrated with anything else. The number that are actually in a network, a group of hospitals, physicians, other providers, insurers working together, that's like 1,600. Like, you know, 10%, you know, 15% are actually working together with someone else to deliver care. So lots of opportunity. So this was my world that I lived in. So I had 5 electronic medical systems across all of the 100 hospitals. There were more than 15 physician practice systems, but we had different builds of the same system, different interpretations or philosophies on different fields, valid values. You know, if you had a list of things like gender is the one I always use, because gender should have 3 values, MF and U, male, female, and unidentified. And every once in a while, somebody'd stick an other in there. That's interesting, but I don't know what to do with that from an analytics perspective. And the data is created locally, so their interpretation of it is local. And so while you might think that you've defined these 5 or 6 parameters, how they interpret it and bucketize and select that could be very different. So you might get your results and go, wow, that doesn't really quite look right. And when you go back and talk to people, they're like, well, that's not what that meant to me. And so your data gets skewed. So we want to link data across these systems and be more efficient from a healthcare delivery perspective and care settings. Fantastic, great idea. But sometimes putting together healthcare data can be like comparing apples and pencils. I mean, we say comparing apples and oranges, that's hard, but apples and pencils is really hard. And so that's the world I lived in. It's a wonder I don't have a lot more gray hair, because it's a very challenging work to do, very noble and aspiring, but very challenging. So if we look at messaging, so we talk about that integration, about 85% healthcare organizations, hospitals, are sending out messages. 65% are receiving it. But the reality is they're using different messaging capabilities. They're using the electronic health record. They're using these HIEs. They're using physician portals. So again, what ends up happening is that, yeah, we send it, but then do we actually use it? You know, it's going up, went from 38 to 40% of the time we actually use it. It's pretty challenging. You know, it's new. We're on that 17-year adoption cycle, I think. Hopefully it's more like 15 years or something. But it's been a slow haul in the U.S. to be able to actually get the data sent, received, and used, and then actually being able to find the data once you know it's there is pretty challenging too. So look, you know, a number of places that are actually receiving summaries of care data, and that's really what we generally send, especially in an HIE world, we'll send like a PDF, a summary. So behavioral health providers, long-term care, outside ambulatory, outside of hospital. And this is really great that these people are starting to understand what happens and what medications you took while you were in the hospital so that we can titer you off or keep you on medications and we don't have people getting sick from just medication reconciliation is a big problem. But really, how far have we come? This is for the emergency room. How often do emergency rooms routinely send information back to their primary care doctor? Well, in reality, if you're in the same system, which you know we saw the number was 1,600 out of 5,600 actually are in a network, less than 30% of the time, we're actually even knowing that you went to the emergency room, which is the most expensive care that you can get outside of ICU. And so it's really, some of this really has to change, and we have to get better at integrating the data. So again, the reason that people are not, don't have what we call interoperability is that they really lack the ability, their EHR, you saw all those numbers of EHRs, many times they just, the system can't do it because you looked at, we're increasing the number that are certified for technology, but it's still not as high as it needs to be. Or they lack other systems to actually interpret the data and get it to the clinician. And so all of these things are, improving over time, and we're tracking them on an annual basis. But it's definitely, there's difficulty matching patients. There's cumbersome workflows to actually say, send it to somebody. We started out with something where I worked, we started out with something very basic, like e-prescribe, which is, you know, your prescription, sending it to your grocery pharmacy, and that was very successful. But I think we only were able to do it about 60% of the time. And it was a very expensive activity. So what are we forgetting about? I don't know why he's kind of cut off. We can't forget what our consumers go through in accessing our system. Care happens across providers, primary care specialists, pharma, radiology. Integration is happening slowly. Really the only place in the U.S. that you can get kind of this complete picture of what's been consumed from an insurance claim perspective, not an out-of-pocket perspective, is the claim. And that's great while you're on the same plan, but again, we renew it every year. We're shifting towards high deductibles, so people are staying away until they're really sick, and we don't have that common identifier. So every vendor is coming up with these matching algorithms. So it's very complicated for people once they get into the system. So the real opportunity is around consumer technology, I believe. Digitization within care is interesting, but I think for Finland, I think for the U.S., I think there's really an opportunity to look at mobile apps. There's over 165,000 health and healthcare apps on the market, but 36 of them were where really nearly half the downloads are. 75% were on health and wellness, 25% on disease management, 90% were free, 34 connect you to your social network. And what we look at is when we see physician activity, when physicians actually engage and start to prescribe, hey, you need to use this mobile health application, 30-day adherence went up 10% greater than if the person downloaded on their own. And for fitness app, it was up 30%. And so as we start to, again, change clinical practice and get physicians engaged in people's health and creation of health, I think there's huge opportunities. There is a major barrier, and that's the lack of integration of that data back into the electronic medical record. Most physicians will say, hey, I don't want to know how many steps you walked today. And again, I think this is where you can have personal health information, you can have clinical health information, and you can use analytics to create those predictive optimizations and outliers and alerts and communicate with the person and in agreement with their clinician when they're out of range. And we use digital capabilities to help us help ourselves. The emerging funding is into virtual reality. There's some really interesting immersive experience, virtualized on the care setting side. We're now talking about EICU, at home ICU, intensive care, where you may not go to an expensive hospital, you may be in your home, and using virtual and augmented reality to deliver care, patient education, get people engaged, improving telemedicine capabilities. So I worked in a group that was the largest rural healthcare. So we worked in many of the places similar to, like, if you were in Lapland, probably don't have the same, you know, number and big medical facilities as what you have in Jyväskylä or in Helsinki. And so we had telepharmacy, we had teleradiology, we had EICU, electronic ICU, where someone could be monitored and sent to a bigger care center if they needed. I think what's really missing is process and mapping as to understand why people are accessing care the way they're accessing it, and looking at the view from the consumer's lens, and what is healthcare doing to help them get healthy and get back on their feet. So as we think about biotech and pharma effectiveness, again, this pay for performance is really going to change how pharmaceutical companies operate. Again, about a third to a half of patients are what we call non-compliant. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. I think that's a clinical term. I think in reality, it's been proven. Most people do a cost-benefit analysis and go, you know, especially some of these medications, these new ones are very expensive. And on the outpatient side, in the U.S., the insurance will not pay. They're like, I will pay $5, you pay $100. People go, I don't have $100. So they don't get it. They don't even pick it up. They're like, I don't even want to know what that means. So again, I think biopharmacy is becoming a key strategic player in health, in digital health, as a partner. And it will accelerate the ability to collect data using digital technologies. There's solutions for prevention, healthcare, or self-care, behavior modification, compliance. And really, pharma has got a big, you know, monkey on their back, as we would say, to show how they actually save lives or improve outcomes, and let alone reduce cost. So again, the opportunity is about a $200 billion opportunity for drug compliance and medical adherence. It's also an opportunity, digitization, an opportunity to improve clinical trials. Today, we know that clinical trials were kind of done in a little vacuum, and now we could keep that bridge open longer and keep collecting data even after we've gotten what we would say FDA, Food and Drug Administration approval. And that we could actually prove the value of efficiency and efficacy. We could also look for drug interactions. There's so many people taking multiple drugs that what it is they need another drug because the other two drugs didn't get along. And if we could really figure that out and reduce the number of drugs people are on, I think people, you know, would feel better and not have to be, you know, schedule their life around taking medication. So again, digitization also has an opportunity around influencing behaviors. I think there's a study around ethnography that has a lot of interest, looking at how human cultures evolve with systems. Social networking analysis, I had a chance to meet Christakis and Fowler. They did some very interesting work looking at a 30 or 40 year period of the Framingham Heart Study. And the network phenomena appears that obesity spread because it was a social norm. They watched it in the Framingham Heart Study. It became a socially acceptable that this person, and it's a very interesting study on how people learn from each other. There's multiple social contacts, so hyperdidactic spread is what creates these reinforced behaviors, as opposed to simple. People mimic each other. You know, if somebody, you know, is wearing, you know, their scarf this way, then I go, oh, that's very interesting. Maybe next time I'll wear my scarf this way, right? That's a very simple mimicking kind of behavior. But health is really created with multiple interactions. And then this notion of 3 degrees of separation, what our friends do really impacts us because we talk about it, it becomes part of our social network. So I think social networking analysis, again, has a lot of opportunity. From an ethnography perspective, there's some really interesting research methods looking at interviews and observations. I really think that this health insurance and social services data that you're collecting from a digitalization perspective can be these observations. And I think the implications are that you can decode those values into a choice architecture and looking at social structures. And then from a social networking analysis, you can look at longitudinal statistical models for obesity. Again, weight gain in one person was associated with weight gain in another. They used cluster analysis. And I think with multi-year data sets, it's really possible to understand where networks exist and how to influence those networks. So the technologies, the experiential learning is also an area that's become very big in the US. There's a Center for Body Computing at the University of Southern California. Very interesting work. They're actually having people simulate what it's like to have COPD. So if you get, you know, congestive heart failure, that, you know, you experience what it's like to not be able to breathe. Diabetics, they can put sensors on you and help you visualize. People, you know, again, we're overly optimistic and we discount the future because it's not real to us. And so this body computing and consumer engagement using virtual and augmented reality has a lot of opportunity. And then the wearables that we have that can help us monitor things like our heart rate, our mental and behavioral health. There's a group called Lantern that's looking at self-improvement and emotional well-being. They've tracked that. And there's just different ways that we can start to look at digitization. Other methods that we can use to understand behaviors, Really incorporating this balanced portfolio of opportunities is going to be really, really important as you think about digitization and integrating with other disciplines. I think in the past, we kind of think very linear in our models, and I think now our opportunity to involve other disciplines and looking at social networks has a huge opportunity for the work that's being done here at the University of UofEscola. So when we start really thinking about what people want in their decision making, it's complex, it's personal, but in reality, what people want is they want to know all the options and the scenarios. They want to consult their preferred sources. They use their own perceptions. They use social networks. They use medical care. They use the internet. And they will evolve if you lay out the options and give them choices. We know that they do a cost-benefit analysis. We know that they make rational choices based on their own perceptions. And we know that in addition to medical care, they turn to their family and friends. And they know that when they are in control, if they have self-management, they feel more in control, and they're much more likely to have a partnership and really be able to move forward with their health. So the non-compliance example that I talked about was people carried out this cost-benefit analysis, and it was their perceptions as to whether or not they took medications. Again, it could have been a cost, a physical cost. It could have been the time cost. There's lots of different ways that people make decisions. So in finishing, there's really kind of two paths forward. We'll look at one in the current healthcare model in Silicon Valley, California. Silicon Valley, as you may know, is the home of the dot-com startups, lots of multimillionaires, Google, Amazon, a number of the high-tech companies are located in Silicon Valley. And you think, wow, wouldn't that be a great place to live? Well, it is if you're in technology, but there's also this safety net care, and we'll talk about what that means. And then we're going to talk about Pokemon Go. What can that high-tech marketing teach us about creation of health? So in the Silicon Valley, the safety net is very alive and well because we have a very high median income. But what you can see is that really 45% of the people have a lot of money, and then the rest of the people, 65%, have no money. And we have a very high homeless population. 33% of the populations live below what we call a living wage. That's not even a sustainable living wage, saving for retirement and one-time health costs. That's just paying their rent every month, their rent and their utilities and food and transportation. So they created a Center for Population Health Improvement that really used data, and they integrated a number of projects. They looked at analytics, and what they started to look at was they had six really key systems, but they had over 100 other systems that were really going to be drivers of being able to actually give them a complete data set. And then they started to look at the population and their services and the improvements. And so as they started to look at the medical data from places like Epic, behavioral data from the emergency rooms, claims data from insurance providers, custody data, talking about, this is like while they're incarcerated, so the criminal justice system, they created a score. And they said, we really need to understand what's going on and where we have our most opportunities. So when they looked at how hard it was to match, it depended on the identifiers, the skill sets of the database administrators, support of the leadership. Again, many times as executives, people come to you and they say, this is a great idea. What do you think? Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And then I go talk to my team, my database people, and they're like, no. Let me tell you what it's really going to be like, right? So they, it get easier after each iteration, but it was not easy because they thought they could use Epic's data warehouse. Not necessarily. It required a patient identifier or a social security number, which I just told you we don't use as a general rule, for a 100% match, so we didn't get a 100% match. So they had to create their own matching algorithm. So that's fuzzy logic. Anytime you have fuzzy logic, you might have fuzzy outcomes, right? So they elected for a high but a not perfect match because they wanted to err on the side of inclusivity as opposed to exclusivity. So when they looked at high users, so the top 1,000 users of their medical systems, they had 1,000 records out of 180,000 in the general population visits. They had 94% of them had emergency room visits versus 32. The average number of visits, 8.7. Many times, these were not paid for because they didn't have insurance. So this is why that uninsured value that you saw for policy was very important. On average, usually people don't go to the emergency room, but this was a high utilizer of emergency room. These are extended patient stays. 49% of the time, they had extended patient stays. The 2.5 times, you know, 2.5 visits they would have. And 45% of the time, they were using both of those services. So again, 50% of the time, behavioral health visits as well. So they were really trying to identify those high utilizers and where they could go. So it's a very complicated system to put together. And that was just for one county in California. That was not scalable across the US. So I think if you look at digitization opportunities for Jyväskylä and Finland, I think there's an opportunity to look at new markets differently. Thinking about Pokemon, can we incorporate health into daily living? Can we think about healthcare guidelines as an opt-in? Can we use virtual and augmented reality to move people? Can we use technology that speaks consumer, that knows where you are and what you like, that has your digital fingerprint? But it also allows people to hide. I mean, sometimes you don't want everybody to know that you're not doing the best. And so it can link to your social network if they choose. It can don't tell, but it lets other people seek. And use incentives. Think of microfunding. The reason I'm working with the actuary in South Africa is they have a behavioral economic model built into their insurance. So if you do the things you should do, you walk your 10,000 steps, you drive safely, they have a camera in your car, you get money towards airfare so you can go, you know, visit the United States. It isn't about, Yvonne, you need to lose weight. We have something called Weight Watchers. Here, I'm going to pay for you to go to Weight Watchers. I don't want to go to Weight Watchers. I want to come visit Finland. So pay, give me money towards my trip to Finland. And it looks at people and their behaviors and what motivates them as opposed to being this rational, logical, I'm going to do this. I think that's where the opportunities lie in changing health and how people think about their health as an enabler of getting them out to do what they want to do. So I think we need to look at marketing technology landscape. If you look at marketing technology, it's very developed. I know this is very busy, but I think it's fascinating. Look at all the different technologies that are being used to sell you. If you go online, we know more about your digital fingerprint than your doctor knows about your health. We know what you like, and we know what you're doing. We know because your GPS tracker in your phone tells us different things. And so how do we use your digital fingerprint, your consumer digital fingerprint, as opposed to in conjunction with your healthcare digital fingerprint to actually move and change people? Because we know that people are triggered, but you have to make it easy, make it desirable, make it rewarding, what motivates you, and ultimately we'll make it a habit and we'll remove those barriers. This is a Unilever, which is a soap, you know, a consumer products company. This is how consumer products companies think. This is not how healthcare thinks in the United States. And it's why we have a problem with creating health, because it doesn't address how people actually are motivated and move. Our behaviors is a new reality. There are no panaceas. There are no easy fixes. The scales have tipped, and they're not going to go back. Medical care is expensive. Wellness is something that can be reinforced. Individuals and their competency and heuristics and choices are all in concert about, you know, driving the care, and consumerism will really be the thing that we need to think about. So as we end, I think that, you know, evolving from our current focus on sick care, unhealth, is going to require curiosity. It's going to require a level of compassion We didn't get here overnight, and people aren't doing things, you know, because they want to be, you know, bad. It's going to take courage. It's going to take collaborative partnership. But ultimately, it's going to take consumer activation and engagement. So special thanks to Tony, certainly, for inviting me to come over. Special thanks to my husband for coming along with me. If you have thoughts or questions, those are my email addresses. And then one last thought to Puffin Power. I view puffins as very interesting. I think they take the road not traveled. They go out to sea for about 9 months. They come on land only 3 months a year. During mating season, they get these bright orange-colored bills. And they remind me of Robert Frost. Maybe you know this poem, The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled. And that has made all the difference. So, questions, thoughts?
There's a microphone. So, thank you very much. But you also have the.
It's on.
So you also have the integrated health systems in the U.S., like Kaiser and Mayo Clinic. So are they more efficient? Are they more like Finland?
Kaiser Permanente is just physician practice. They don't own hospitals. So what they do is they're what we consider an HMO, a health maintenance organization. They limit the number of options that you have. And so actually their numbers are going down because more people are saying, I don't want you to limit the care. I will go high deductible and pay more to get to see the providers that I want to see. So from an efficiency perspective, they are more efficient. You may not pay as much for your monthly premium, but it's not the choice that people make. Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, are physician practice, physician-owned organizations. They tend to be very in that specialized category. So they tend to be more medical tourism. People come. I have very rare, a friend of mine had a kidney issue. And liver. His liver stopped. And so his sister, who lives in Denver, and him go to Mayo Clinic. They take one third of her liver, and they give it to him. And so they do a liver transplant. Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, are very much institutes, high technology medical institutes. So they tend to be very cardiovascular, liver, cancer. You don't go there for general care. They have primary care, but it's not where they make their, it's not their most high dollars.
So you have experience in ICT implementation.
Oh, ICT 10.
Can you say a few words about the recommendation to Finland? Because we are thinking what kind of ICT system we have in our...
What do you have now? Are you not on 10? ICT 10?
Yeah.
Are you? I was going to say, we just went to 10. We waited many, many, many years. Only 1 year ago in the fall, we went to 10. And it was delayed and delayed. So we were on ICD 9 for many years. So it's not been as many hiccups, but I don't know that people have looked at the data because you went from 15,000 codes to 130,000 diagnoses. So it's hard to tell how people are actually using it to see if it's really gotten us better information. It's a big deal.
Okay, are there some other questions? If not, we close and have the discussion in a more informal way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.